Session number 26579.
Mr. Clark, Rail 12. Now, we're talking about this nasty clash with some Malayan terrorists in the jungle. And what was cut off was what happened after you'd counted up the casualties. And I think you're going to tell me about them while it's in.
Yeah. What happened was that as soon as the battle was finished, Danny Brown got the radio back to company headquarters, the company commander, and he reported the state of the patrol after this action, and reported the fact that we had 4 dead, and estimated that at least another 2 who escaped were wounded. And he then gave the company commander her grid reference where we were, and the company commander then told Sergeant Brown to, he gave Sergeant Brown a grid reference to the nearest road, and to send someone out to the road to as a marker to get the company transport. If you send quite a bit of company transport out to pick us up, plus ambulances and what have you, like, you know, medical team.
Now you had the 2 dead, straight dead. Did you take them with you?
No, well, what we did, we left them there. We tried to make them as comfortable as possible. And what we had to do was to get them onto a bamboo pole, get a couple of bamboo poles down, because there's no we didn't have any stretchers. And we got the bamboo poles ready in case we had to carry them out, tie them onto the bamboo poles, which was a mode of getting wounded and dead out of the jungle. But as luck would have it, when the ambulance arrived from battalion headquarters, they had stretchers, you know, the canvas stretchers. Anyway, we did the best we could to sort ourselves out, and Danny Brown was terrific. You know, some of the lads were really upset, these 2 guys lying there. We were covered them with our ground sheets, like, you know. Now, the eldest of the 2 was a bloke called Valence. He was a National Service, well, they were both National Service men. And Valence had only been married 3 weeks before he left UK to come out to the battalion. Little Holland, but they both came from Ayrshire, funnily enough. Little Holland was so small, I used to have to detail a man to make sure to look after him when he went into the swamps in case he fell into a hole. It was all in good fun, but half in fun and half in earnest. And I thought the world of these 2 guys. Absolutely thought the world of them. And sadly, before that, an episode had happened in a camp which really upset me. When they were lying there, this episode in the camp before the patrol had upset me. What happened was, one day, I was sitting, the mail had just come in from the UK, and I was sat at the edge of my bed in the tent. I was Scotland in charge of the tent, and little Holland was sat there reading his letters. Valence, who had been on patrol, the perimeter patrol, with the loaded weapon, came in for a break, and he put his rifle on his bed. And as he was going up to the Charwallis to get a cup of tea and a bun, and as he left the tent, I shouted, "I hope you unloaded this weapon." "Oh, yeah, yeah, it's all right, Corporal." Anyway, what happened was, I'm sitting there reading my local paper, when the next thing is one God Almighty bang, and all the earth came up and hit me in the face. And I looked, and there's no soul in my boot. We used to wear ammunition boots in camp. And what had happened was, young Holland had picked up their rifle that hadn't been unloaded, and he took aim at my foot. Click. I hope it was a click, but it wasn't a click, it was a bang. So I shoved the pair of them in close arrest straight away, because I always hated enemy pointing a weapon at enemy. So it finished up. In those days you didn't get clinked unless it was really serious. They both lost 28 days pay, and unfortunately they never lived to receive their pay again, because during that period that they died. And you can understand how I felt, like, you know. So it was a terribly, terribly emotionally upsetting time for me. But then again, I had to get on with it. So what happened was, this rifleman came back to say that the company commander had arrived and to stay where we were, and that he would lead the medics and what have you in, like, you know. So that was it. In they came. And the other thing was, when we went on patrol, we had to take a camera with us, so that if we killed terrorists, if we couldn't get them out, we had to photograph them. So we photographed these guys, and then they took them away. We got all loaded back onto the trucks, got back to the camp, and I was taken to the medical centre at battalion headquarters, and I got this stitched just under my chin there. I got a couple of stitches in it, and that was it. Now, as a result of this patrol, this battle, William McLaughlin won the military medal for killing this terrorist with his bare hands. So it had its moments.
Were you nervous in action? I mean, you know, or did you not have
the,
time?
To me, the reaction set in when we got back. It was virtually the next day the reaction set in. And I went sick, like, you know, I went and seen the Sergeant Major, like, I told him, I said, I feel terrible, like, you know, he said, well, I said, it's understandable, he said. So I'll send you down to battalion headquarters, go sick. So I went down there sick, and what happened was, I got excused all duties for a week. And the doctor said, if possible, stay in your bed. And he sent a message through to come to the commander to this effect, like, you know, that if they saw me in bed, to not to charge me, like, you know. And after a week, I was as right as any could be. But the thing was, your training kicked in, you know. And at the end of the day, in those days, there was no counsellors or what have you. The regimental sergeant major was a counsellor. The company sergeant major was a counsellor, like, you know. They sorted you out. And although this guy, John Dale, was a pretty quiet going bloke and all that, he could be very strict. He had a bit of steel in him. And at the end of the week, he said to me, well, how are you, Clark? I said, oh, not too bad. I said, right, he said, we'll get you back out and patrol with your platoon. And that was it.
So it was more a reaction to the casualty. You weren't nervous in yourself. It was just the shock of it.
I mean, something new got into you. But once you've been in battle, then you know, a reaction does set in, like, you know. Prior to getting into battle, you're okay. But then, and then I say, for me, under the circumstances, with these two lads being killed and there was no pay, I took it pretty bad, like, you know. And I must confess that for the next couple of months, I was knocking the beer back. Till one morning I woke up and I thought, well, this solves nothing, like, you know.
So what's the next thing you remember?
Not a lot, just the fact that it became a sort of way of life. Patrols, what have you. Then the next patrol we went on, but then there came a time when the headhunters arrived. We had the headmen were drafted in from, where was it? Sarawak. These men were allocated so many to each company. And they took on patrols with us. And they were absolutely DIAC trackers. DYAK trackers. They had their earlobes hanging down. They were covered in tattoos. And they were actually real live headhunters. Now, this made life for us very easy in the jungle.
And why? What?
Because they were born and brought up in that kind of environment. And the least noise, they'd stop patrol and would listen. Even smell, they could smell human beings at a certain distance. Absolutely remarkable. And they slept in a tent next to a big tent next to the garden. We had about six of them. And they used to sit in there at night and they smoke away and drink their beer and that. But they were dressed virtually as they would be in the jungle. Anyway.
Could they speak? I mean, how did you communicate with them? Or
no, we had an Indian bloke who could speak their lingo. He was he translated for us. And he had a rifle. He was dressed just like us, this translator. But these boys just had their normal, what they were wearing in Sarawak. Anyway, a few weeks after these guys arrived, we had another encounter with the terrorists. And once again, two were killed. But it wasn't my section this time. It was another section. And what happened was, when these two terrorists were killed, the Dayak tracker got his sword out. His big, wasn't it, sword, it was a, what's it called him? I forget what they called him. Big, long weapon. And it was razor sharp. And he just ran amok and he beheaded the two terrorists and started to suck their brains out. Yeah, that's how primitive they were. And the blokes were going behind trees apparently, bringing their hearts up, like they were spewing up all over the place. And this bloke, he was absolutely out of it, like, you know. Anyway, when they managed to get him calmed down and got him pacified, the patrol commander said, what are we going to do now about bringing these guys back to be identified? And that this corporal said, I'll show you what to do, sir. And he got the two heads, he stuck them against a tree and said, right lads, smile, you're on camera, and took the photograph to get it back with identification. So that's how the jocks started to take to this kind of life. Like, you know, they became immune to any sort of, we become immune to any sort of things that we'd never experienced before, like, you know. And then that was it.
Your patrols weren't attacked again?
No, not while I was there. They were attacked later on, after I left. I left. In actual fact, I asked to extend my tour for another extra 4 months because, you know, there was a shortage of NCOs and that. And I went to the company commander and said, I'm prepared to stay for another 4 months. So he said, no problem. He said, well, that's no problem. And I stayed on for another 4 months extra. I was due to come. I forget the dates now. I was due to come home. So I thought, if I get this 4 months in, I'll get home just in time for Christmas and New Year, hopefully.
That would be
51.
Christmas 51 or Christmas
51. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So you decided to extend. Now, what about any of your ambushes? Had any of them worked?
No. We simply because although we set up ambushes based on what we thought was decent intelligence, the enemy never appeared.
So they were always just periods where you... How long would you stay in position?
Sorry?
How long would you stay in position?
You can stay up to 3 days in an ambush position. Up to about 3 days in an ambush position. It wasn't very nice at all, believe me. And when you had to eat, you just had to be very quiet, open what you could, or just live in biscuits. But as I say, 3 days, mind, that did mean to say that you were there for 24 hours. An ambush could be, say, from 9 in the morning till just before 3 in the afternoon. For 3 days, because after that, there's no point. Nobody moved after that. Now, before I left, there was a massive operation mounted. I told you before that I'd caught this spy who had been earwigging on a briefing. Now, this briefing was to the fact that our company had to take part in an operation up a mountain called Mount Ophir. And apparently no white troops had ever gone up there. And the colonel reckoned that it would be a good idea to send the company up because they thought there was training camps up there.
And this is called Mount... How does
Mount Ophir. O-P-H. Is it O... O-P... O-P-H... I-F-O-R. Something like that.
I-F-O-R.
Ophir. And off we set, and this...
Now, this was a whole company?
A whole company. Now, it was a very, very difficult operation, tactically especially, information-wise. the object of the exercise was to get the company through the undergrowth and through into the open, the top, about halfway up, there was undergrowth up to about halfway up the mountain, and then it cleared itself. And the intelligence was, they thought that there was training camps up in the clearing, cleared areas. So off we set. It took us a week to get up there. And it was a slog. And the terrible thing about it was, it, there was no flat ground. And at night, when darkness descended, and we set up base camp, you were lying on a slope. And you had to virtually get your foot at the bottom of a tree to keep yourself sliding down, because it was the undergrowth was so damp and wet that you just slid. And you'd any old thing you could get your feet on to keep them sliding down. And sometimes some of the guys slipped and they slid about 100 yards down the mountainside. That was, it was unbelievable, you know. And it's just one of these things that we'd never encountered before. No, we'll probably never encounter again. So it took us about a week to get up there. We got up there, and then we could see that there had been camps there. Obviously, there had been camps. There was all sorts of...
What sort of thing?
Food furniture. Remnants of sacks with food. They'd been carrying rice up the mountain and all that, you know. Don't forget, a lot of these terrorists were pretty tough guys. And they'd have coolies, like, carrying the food up for them, like, you know. And so we just destroyed whatever there was, like, you know, and came back down, and took us about 4 days to get back to camp again. So we had achieved a pretty great distinction, that we were the first white troops ever to climb Mount Ophir. So I don't know what they meant by white troops. Maybe the Gurkhas have been up there, I don't know. But as I say, at this stage, talking about Gurkhas, we were actually in the Gurkha Brigade. It was the 2nd 6th Gurkhas, 2nd 10th Gurkhas, and our battalion, the Cameroonians.
Now, did you get on with the
Gurkhas, excellent. We didn't, in Malaya, we didn't come up against them in Malaya, but in Hong Kong, we joined the brigade in Hong Kong, and we got on famous with them. They were fantastic blokes. We never had any bother with them at all, like, you know. And
were they respected? The Gurkhas? Respected?
Did we respect them? Very much so, and they knew it. And see, plus the fact was, they were light infantry, and so were we light infantry. So we had something in common, a great thing in common. We wore black stripes, we wore black buttons, we wore black headgear off parade, like, you know, operational areas, like, you know.
And did the brigade have a number, or was it just the Gurkha Brigade?
It was just the 26th Gurkha Brigade. And where the signs we wore was the cross cookeries. We were allowed to wear the cross cookeries on our shoulders. That was in Hong Kong as well. Like, you know, we're in the 40th Division. 40th Division. I forget what the emblem was. But we on the one side, we wore the 40th Division sign. And on the other side, the cross cookeries. And we were quite chuffed to wear these emblems, you know.
Now, you just stayed in this camp. Now, you were there from June till Christmas.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you left them.
That's right, yeah.
So
yeah.
You had 6 months
six
there.
Months
but
in
you
the
should have only had 2 months.
That's right,
but
yeah.
But you extended
the way my tour of duty worked out, like, see. So,
did you ever get away from the camp? Was there any recreations organised for you? Or was it
in Malaya? Not when I was there.
So you just basically were in this camp and you had your canteen. You didn't go outside the wire?
No, we weren't allowed to. Oh, no, we didn't. Otherwise, we'd get our ass shot off if we'd gone out there.
Was anybody shooting into the camp? Do you know what I mean?
It didn't happen to us. But the Scots Guards, apparently, took some casualties. They were sitting watching an open-air movie one night, and they had several guardsmen killed. We used to have a cinema show, but maybe once every 2 weeks, open-air cinema. And we used to always have this little fear that they would creep up. But our patrol, sentry patrols were very, very alert during a cinema, like, you know. Pardon me.
Now, so how did when you left? You left on your own, did you? Or I mean, how?
No, there was a crowd of us came home. There was
a whole draft.
Oh, the draft was. I think it was about 50 of us all came home. Went down to Singapore, and we spent about 5 or 6 days in Singapore.
And you were all time expired, or?
Oh yeah, no. We're all. I was what they call a. I'm at home on a layup leave. Leave in addition to Python, as they called it. But it was my overseas tour finished. I should only have done 3 years, but I did the extra, like, you know.
And you came back round about the Christmas period?
Yeah, just before Christmas. It took us 5 weeks, 5 days to get home. The trip to the Lancashire, HMT Lancashire, was the name of the...
Again?
Yeah.
You'd had that before?
That's right, the Lancashire. Took us 5 weeks, and then on the ship, I went down with a bout of malaria. I spent about 10 days in the ship's hospital. And during the...
Carry on.
All the time we were out there, we were compelled to take Mepocrine tablets. Don't ask me how you spell it at the moment. But Mepocrine tablets, little yellow tablets. And every morning, whether you were in camp or out in the jungle, an officer or your platoon commander would supervise you taking this little yellow tablet. And this was to combat malaria. But I still took them quite a...
Had you taken them? You had actually
taken them? I'd taken them, but they must have been pretty ineffective. I don't know what something to do with my system or not. But what happened was that the side effects were terrible. I turned yellow. My skin turned all yellow. And my weight... I used to fight at 9 stone 6. And my weight had gone down to about just over 7 stone. In a hell of a state. And in fact, I remember when I arrived home, my mother burst out crying when she saw the state of me when I got into the house, right? And I had this scar under my chin as well, like, so. But anyway, that's beside the point. The thing was that after a very uneventful 5 days journey, I got home and just in time for Christmas and New Year, I got 12 weeks leave. All accumulated leave. When the leave was finished, I had to report back to the regimental depot.
Now this would be March 51-ish.
Yeah. And they report back to the depot. Now at the time the depots were closed, all the regimental depots were closed, and all the training was done at Dreghorn Camp. Basic training for recruits was done in what they call the Lowland Brigade Training Centre, Dreghorn Camp in Edinburgh. And you had the Royal Scots Fusiliers, King John Scottish Borderers, Cameronians. The unit was commanded by a Cameronian, our old friend again, Lieutenant Colonel Buchanan Dunlop. The Regimental Sergeant Major was a character, a guy called Steenie Morrison of the Royal Scots. He was he epitomised what an RSM should be. Totally brilliant he was. An absolute pig's bastard. But, you know, once again, smashing bloke. Everybody looked up to him. And I was then sent up to A Company, where it was commanded by a bit of a lunatic of the...
This is A Company at Dreghorn with the Lowland Training Brigade.
Yeah, Lowland Brigade Training Centre.
That's right, yeah.
Then I was assigned to a platoon where a platoon sergeant was Sergeant Jock Murray, little King's Own Scottish Borderer. All the instructors in this unit were all mixed up. You know, there was no Cameronian company or KSB company. It was all A Company was the basic training company. And it was all different regiments who were sergeants and corporals were NCOs, instructors. And I was posted there as an instructor. Now, the concept of training had obviously changed from the time I did my basic training, a man was called up, or he volunteered and came in and was posted into the Lowland Brigade Training Centre, and he did 10 weeks straight off the rail. 10 weeks drill, weapon training, range work, all the basics an infantryman needed to be taught. And I was in charge of a barrack room of about 14 recruits. The accommodation was hutted accommodation.
This is at Dreghorn Camp.
Dreghorn Camp.
Is that spelled?
Dreghorn.
Like it says, yeah.
Camp. And
so what were the huts like? And
They were quite comfortable. The stoves at either end, and they were of wooden construction, pretty solid wooden construction, with a room, and then your corporal's room at the end of the...
Now, what was your little corporal's room like? Cause, you know,
it was just bed, locker, and a head locker, and a table, small table, decorated by anything I wanted to put on it, like, you know?
Did they have a window?
Window, yeah. So it was,
and what about, how could you see what was going on in the main room?
No, I couldn't, but...
You could hear it, I presume.
Well, any nonsense, I could hear it, and I'd be out there like a shot. But the thing was that these recruits were, once again, the discipline was very strict. I was very strict in the barrack room. So it meant that things were very quiet in my hut at night. They had to be all sitting down quietly doing their equipment.
Now, tell me about the discipline you enforced. How did you do it?
Just that I made sure that every man in the room had a job. As it has happened virtually in the army since time immemorial, made sure that every man, his bed pack was thoroughly squared off in the morning, his bed, was the blanket was nice and tight. In other words, everything to be ship-shape. His turnout, always checked his turnout before he went on muster parade to make sure that any little thing that needed rectified, I'd get him to rectify it. Every time they spoke to me, I had to stand at attention. Simple as that, and address me as corporal. And it was just the normal, everyday recruit performance.
Now, what do you think they thought of you? I mean, you know, you may not have cared, but what do you...
I think they probably thought, well, you know, it was a shock to their system, coming in from Civvy Street and finding a young bloke snarling at them and making them stand at attention, what have you. I think they accepted me quite well. You know, I never had any hang-ups about it, put it that way.
Do you think they disliked you at first and then got used to it? I mean, you know, did they show any signs of dislike?
No, I never had any show of resentment.
And no. What about any show of appreciation?
Yeah, they did in their own sort of way. Like, you know, I would sometimes I'd break the barrier down. You know, and we'd have a bit of a laugh in the hut at night, things like that, you know? Or I'd get in and tell them a funny story, like, you know? I tried to keep a nice balance between discipline and the approachability. You know, I'd never get to the stage where a bloke would be scared to come and talk to me.
Did you do a lot of shouting at them?
Not a lot, when I required it. So, some NCOs did, but over the top. But I always... I always seem to be lucky. I have this. I knew when to shout, when not to shout.
And
on the square, yes, I would snarl at them on the square. I used to act as a supernumerary to the sergeant. The sergeant would teach the squad drill, and I would be taken out as a. I would go out there and show them how to do a right turn at the halt, a right or left turn at on the march, saluting. You were what they called a supernumerary. And the sergeant would use you as a model, you know, how to salute, how to do the various drill movements, and that was quite interesting, like, you know.